Hello there, and thank you for tuning in to this broadcast. This is Ask the Experts, the program on 94.3 The Bridge, where we invite members of our community to come in and we ask them questions of things you want to know about. If you missed any of our previous broadcasts, you can go to our website, 943thebridge.com, point to the audio link, and click on Ask the Experts and listen to our past broadcasts. In today on Ask the Experts, to answer all your computer questions, is Jimmy Atai from Happy Computing. Jimmy, welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, someone's looking to buy a new computer, and there's all different kinds of numbers staring them in the face. Can you explain the differences between RAM and hard drive space and some of those numbers they might be looking at?
Sure. The analogy I like to use for RAM, the random access memory, is kind of the fast math that you can do in your head. You know 2 plus 2 equals 5. And the square roots, some square roots I can do in my head. Other times I have to reach for a piece of paper for remainders and such. I think of that as the hard drive. If I have to reach for a piece of paper and write it down and reread it, things are slow. If I can do the math in my head, that's what I would like.
Sure.
So the more RAM, the less use of a hard drive is necessary to do the math.
Okay.
So more RAM is always better. More hard drive space lets you keep more. But it's a scratch pad, mostly.
Okay. As people look in the stores today, what are some of the typical RAM space or hard drive space that typical computers in the stores retailing today might be averaging at?
You're going to have a hard time finding anything smaller than a 500 gigabyte hard drive in a conventional hard drive capacity. And what do I mean by conventional? The mechanical, the old school mechanical with the spindles and the arms and the... That's great. Those are slow, but they're conventional and they have a place in the marketplace. The solid state hard drives are the ones that are a lot faster. Worlds of difference as far as speed goes. Most often, you're going to see a conventional hard drive about a terabyte in a tower. 500 gigs maybe, but mostly it's a terabyte or two or four, however you want to...
Would that be enough space for the typical person just doing average computing?
Terabyte will be more than enough unless you've got... years and years of pictures and video and music, and then that's just a matter of preference. How much do you want to store on your computer internally? How much do you want to put it on external type of thing? I personally think anything higher than 1 terabyte is overkill unless you have a need to store that much information. We're talking about thousands of pictures, lots of movies, depending on the quality of the picture and the movie, the resolution. That all makes a difference. So graphic designers, video editors, sound editors, they want the biggest hard drives they can for storage, but not necessarily to – they would prefer to have a solid-state hard drive because everything gets done faster. And that comes at a premium. The average person doesn't need a solid-state hard drive.
So the solid-state hard drive is faster because it's not spinning disks. It's not physically accessing it. It's a maybe similar to like a USB drive in that sense?
Yeah, it's very similar to how RAM works. There are no moving parts. And the exchange of data happens really quickly without parts having to be actuated and moved and slowed down and sped up and synchronized. The average person is going to find a computer with a mechanical hard drive. In the lower levels, the budget models, you're going to have mechanical hard drives left, right, and center. As you get into the mid to high grade pricing is an indicator, you're going to have solid state hard drives. You're going to have touch screens. You're going to have bells and whistles.
What's meant by a hybrid hard drive? Is this a hard drive that's going to help global warming or something like that?
Close. The hybrid hard drive is two drives in one. It's a mechanical hard drive that has solid-state technology built into it, and the controller that handles the mechanics of the device is smart enough to determine that, okay, we're doing some math and some work that can fit into the solid-state hard drive portion, so let's use that. And whatever data we have to write down and record later, let's put it onto this external but the conventional drive. Here, I'm talking about it like it's two drives, but it's one. And it's a hybrid because it controls both avenues of mechanical versus solid-state. It's an intelligent drive. It's been around for a while. The technology came out, I would say 2010-ish. It's a neat idea. It has its problems just like everything else. It's kind of like the old TV that has a built-in VCR and DVD player. Okay? One thing goes wrong, it's all going to the shop. So, yes, as a matter of convenience, it would be great to have one device that's smart enough to figure out what needs to be stored in the faster storage and what needs to be stored in the long-term slower storage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Someone might notice that they can save a lot of money by getting a computer with Chrome as an operating system. What does someone need to know about that machine, buying a computer with a Chrome operating system installed on it?
Chromebooks are neat because they're very affordable and they do very basic things. Very popular in schools, they are. They run an operating system that is dependent on the internet to do all the fun things. In the early days of the Chromebooks, you'd have to be connected to the internet to get onto Google's docs and doing various things online. Now they're making the operating system able to do some things offline without being connected to the internet. It's a great way to get into a computer when you don't have very many needs other than internet and email. And the things that you do are you're interacting with websites.
Mm-hmm.
If that's who you are, get a Chromebook. If you intend on using Microsoft Office or some other Windows-driven software tool that runs your business or your life or makes your life easier, you're not going to enjoy a Chromebook because it's not going to run Windows.
You won't be able to install those software programs on the Chromebook.
No. And when I say no, I really mean maybe. because there are ways to make it do things that it's not designed to do. And us enthusiasts, we like to push that edge of the envelope. Is it something that the average person would want to encumber their life with? No. Doesn't work 100% of the time. When it doesn't work, you need to know how to fix it. And most people just want to push the button and have it do what it does and move on with their life. They don't want to be computer operators or technicians. They just want to be a user.
Mm-hmm. Sure. People also find when they're shopping computers, different kinds of USB ports, 2.0, 3.0. What's the difference between those two things?
2.0 is the old technology. 3.0 is the newer one. The latest technology is 3.1, also known as USB-C. But for keeping things simple, USB 2.0 is significantly slower at writing and reading as far as transfer speeds than USB 3.0. As far as speeds goes, it's significant and it's noticeable. Not all 3.0 USB sticks are made equal. The chips that are being used in flash drives come from various sources, and some of them are cheaper than others. And there are brands of 3.0 USB sticks that are known to be significantly faster than the others. And you usually know that from the price tag.
Should a user pay attention to those ports? So if I'm plugging in my keyboard or my mouse, I might want to save the higher speeds for the external hard drive, things like that?
Sure. That would be a good idea. Everything is backward compatible, so if you have an open port that's not designed for the device that you're using, you can still use it.
Okay.
I like to use keyboards and mice plugged in and printers to plug into USB 2.0 ports.
Mm-hmm.
External drives, flash drives, those are the things that you want the 3.0 with.
Okay, great. Someone wants to make sure that their computer will work on their home wireless network. Can you explain the different kinds of Wi-Fi bands and what people might need to know about all that?
Right. More common than not is going to be, let's take the geek vocabulary out of my head. So you have Wi-Fi that is indicated to the user in materials and on the display of various devices as 2.4G or 5G, 2.4 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz. The 2.4 is very common. That's used in cordless phones and various other devices. Gigahertz limits the interference because not as many devices transmit on that band. 2.4 gigahertz, interestingly enough, covers longer distances than the 5 gigahertz. Oh. The 5 gigahertz is really, really significantly faster than 2.4 in areas where you have direct line of sight. It doesn't travel very far, well through walls and obstacles, not as well as the 2.4 gigahertz. So, yes, all routers and devices these days offer the 2.4 gigahertz band. They offer the 5 gigahertz. Some people have heard about AC as a wireless technology. That's newer technology that handles beamforming, where the signals are not just thrown up in the air like a big old bag of confetti that you pick up and reassemble on your own. Mm-hmm. It's directly beaming toward an end point.
Okay.
And it learns really well what devices can handle what. And, hey, you know, if it's too far away from the router, it's going to drop down to 2.4 gigahertz speeds. It should, and that's a big old S word. a lot of things should, but they don't.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How can people make sure that their wireless networks are secure?
Most devices that you go and buy from a store will have instructions in your face about how to do it. If you're not the type of person to read instructions and plug it in, it's going to work. But you might want to think about reading some instructions just to make sure what is it that you're dealing with. Most routers, they are designed for you to rip the box open, plug it in, plug a few things in, and be directed with an online screen shot of here, click this next and configure that and et cetera. I personally like to change the default password that comes with these devices. These routers will have us, you know, Netgear has this cute little method of writing strange words like owl skiing 2462.
Hmm.
Random, but they're set at the factory. And if somebody comes into your house, like an electrician or somebody, they can look underneath the router, read that number, write it down, and go out in your mm-hmm. driveway around the corner and start using internet. How is that going to happen in a small town environment? Not likely, but mm-hmm. in the big cities, it's a common thing.
Or the old routers that would just have admin as logins. And
right.
You wouldn't even have to have access to the yeah. physical box.
Right. That's the other thing. A lot of defaults are convenient for the consumer, but it's crippling when you don't understand the consequences of not changing these things. And that's okay. People don't teach this in school.
Mm-hmm.
But I would secure a wireless network by changing the default password that the manufacturer sets for Wi-Fi access to something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I would change the admin password to manage the router. Who wants to manage a router? Well, me, not the average person. But why would you want to manage a router? Like, you would want to say, okay, this printer is wireless, and it has a specific wireless address that I want to set manually. Nobody else can have this address. Most people don't care about this, but once you start having multiple devices, you've got a router that claims to be able to manage things automatically. Anytime you have a piece of software or hardware making decisions on your behalf, you'd have to understand why they're making those decisions, how to override them, because they're not especially smart. A programmer thinks differently than an electrician or a carpenter or a baker.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things get lost in translation and get misunderstood, and in the end, it's all manageable. It's just find someone who knows about this stuff and cares about it and ask them questions.
All right. If I want to upgrade my existing computer and, say, add more RAM or something like this, is this something that the average user can buy online and install themselves, or is this something they should probably have a professional do?
Oh, I'm more than happy to encourage people to do it themselves if they can. A lot of these things that I do are easily learned on YouTube. The things that you don't learn on YouTube are necessarily well taught on YouTube are electrostatic discharge circumstances. You touch a doorknob and you hear it and you feel it. That's a number of factors stronger than it needs to be to blow an integrated circuit.
Mm.
So you could touch something, not hear it, not feel anything, and it's blown.
Mm.
So having said that, this is not brain surgery to upgrade RAM. Let's say for a desktop computer. Laptops are becoming built in such a way that more and more often you don't get to change things. They're soldered on. Even if you can unglue the case and get access to it, you might be disappointed that you can't take that RAM chip out and put another one in.
Hmm.
Mostly Apple laptops are practically unserviceable. The latest versions that have been coming out in the past few years. More and more often it becomes a throwaway item that after 3-4 years, you're not going to upgrade anything but the software, and at some point the hardware is not going to be able to run the software that the manufacturer says that you need to run. So then you go out and buy more, and their stock goes up.
Mm-hmm. So it's more of a marketing strategy than a technical strategy.
Right. That's true.
Windows 10 has been out for a little while now. If people didn't upgrade during the free offering, can they still upgrade to Windows 10? And what would they be looking at if so?
You can always upgrade to Windows 10. Microsoft will take your money any chance that they get. It's about $110, $140, depending on where you buy. You can go to Microsoft and buy it directly. You can get it at a discount online if it's a reputable retailer. There are some people out there who have articles written online that say, you can still upgrade to Windows 10 for free. Here's a loophole. Well, if you're interested in loopholes and the consequences that come up with it, there's plenty of websites that will say, here's how to do it.
What do you mean by the consequences that come with it?
You know, Microsoft wants to make money off their operating system. That's their business model. They don't have Microsoft cops going door to door that I know of and knocking and making sure that the citizens are complying with the rules and regulations that nobody really pays attention to anymore. When you read that EULA and user licensing agreement, you're entering into a contract. And I don't remember seeing anybody who said, Jimmy, I want you to come back in a week after I've read this. Windows 10 is an operating system that you can install for a free upgrade if during the process of installing it you choose to indicate to the setup process these windows and screens that tell you and ask you questions. If you tell them that I have accessibility needs and I have poor vision or my typing, I can't use my hands very well, there are accessibility features built into Windows 10 to make it usable by anyone and everyone. Now, for some reason, if you choose to install Windows 10 using one of these methods that are listed online on various websites, you can get Windows 10 installed without buying a key, and it'll grandfather you in to some sort of free upgrade. Anytime those situations come up, I'm not leery so much as to say, hey, go out and do this, because I know it'll work. But what are the consequences as far as a software licensing agreement? I haven't passed the bar. I understand legalese more so than I want to, but it intimidates me to want to go around a method that may not necessarily be the method that Microsoft goes out and puts on billboards and says, hey, free Windows 10, do this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the consequences. But the wording of the end-user licensing agreement is such that I'm not going to challenge it
mm-hmm.
and survive it without doing a lot of preparation work, and I don't have the time for it.
Okay. Tell us some regular tasks that computer users can do to keep their system maintained running smoothly as possible.
Well, this is a double-edged sword in our industry. We have, when we talk to ourselves, us techs, we can't agree on whether we should encourage people to do their software updates all the time or hold off, wait until somebody else gets hit by the bug, and then you do it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so is it good advice to say hold off on Windows updates? No, because you're going to be open to security issues that may have been known for decades or months or weeks, or somebody just figured it out yesterday. So people have bad experiences with updates. Whether it's Windows or Mac, it doesn't matter. They're all the same. Most of the time, Windows updates will cause more trouble than Mac software updates. And Windows updates are significantly more prone to messing up a computer, especially in the Windows 10 age, because if you haven't noticed, there are some editions of Windows 10 that you can't have any control over automatic updates. That's changing. In the next few releases of Windows 10, there's an update coming out that supposedly will give you the ability to delay the updates instead of saying, hey, my Windows computer says I have to reboot now. I'm in the middle of doing a report. There's a timer counting down. What do I do? What do I do? That's the main complaint that I have from Windows 10 users, is that they don't have control over it unless they've paid some exorbitant licensing fee and got the Enterprise edition of Windows 10.
Hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm getting sidetracked. You asked the safest way to keep you safe. Yes, updates. Get them.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the safe answer. If you don't want to be the early adopter, get onto a search engine and start researching the update, and you'll find out more than you ever wanted to know. Most people just call the computer guy and say, is it safe? Is it safe to do it yet? It'd be best to err on the side of caution.
What about virus protection?
Windows comes with virus protection. It has been rated as stellar and poor over the years. Microsoft has Microsoft, boy, they have several different names for it. Now it's called Windows Defender, and it's built into Windows. It's better than nothing. Antivirus is, depending on who you talk to in the business, is an antiquated notion, much like the password. But that's a story for another
okay.
show. Yes, you need antivirus, but the threats today aren't coming from viruses per se. Most statistically, they're all malware. They're toolbars. They're marketing add-ons. They're, hey, download this map something, and we'll make your trip really easy. By the way, here's a weather app for you to bundle into your experience. And what, wouldn't you like to have a shopping comparison toolbar to go with that? We have two. Would you like both of them? So these are the little check marks that you might see in the installation of various programs that seemed legitimate. And some antivirus programs will detect that and remove them, but most of them won't. Anti-malware is an area of the of research and that's gaining in popularity because that's what's coming out is malware. It's somebody figuring out that there's a hole, there's a chink in this armor, and if I poke it this way, it's going to fall apart and I can do whatever I want.
Hmm.
Anti-malware programs, any Windows machine that I see, I will install a free trial of Malwarebytes anti-malware. I don't have any relationship with the company. It is my go-to tool to remove stubborn things. It has a really good reputation. It's not the only game in town, but it works with me, and I know its idiosyncrasies. So I'll throw a free trial on anybody's computer that comes across me.
Okay.
That's the most important thing, anti-malware. Whatever antivirus you have, it'll do the job of an antivirus. But it's more to make you feel good about yourself protecting your computer than actually protecting your computer. Yes, there are viruses out there. Yes, you need to be protected by viruses. Some virus protection has a better record of detecting and removing things. Other programs are a waste of money.
Hmm.
A lot of antivirus vendors are bundling anti-malware features into their security suites. And their marketing people swear up and down that this is the only thing you need. It'll protect you from everything, floods and hurricanes. It'll flip your eggs in the morning too.
Fantastic.
But the truth is you need to supplement your protection on your computer. Lots of different ways of protecting your computer, but now it's just become a game of layers of protection. Antivirus doesn't protect you anymore. You need antivirus and anti-malware. What about a firewall? What about an ad blocker? What about? There's plenty to talk about. So here's a shorter answer to your question. You get yourself a decent antivirus. Doesn't matter which one. I prefer Kaspersky, Bitdefender, some of the larger names. And they all have some sort of controversy associated with them. Kaspersky is associated with Russia, and then Bitdefender is Eastern European, and that's. But they're very good products that show up as the top in the results of the tests year over year over year, consistently in the top two or three or five offerings. A lot of these offerings that I read about aren't available, or people haven't heard of them because they're European. But antivirus, great, get it. Malwarebytes, get it. Get a security add-on for your browser called AdBlock Plus. It'll block ads. Interestingly enough, it's an ad blocker that allows ads to go through, unless you put a check mark. Remove a check mark from a box. Anyway, so then there is this other security add-on I like to put on, and depending on which operating system, which browser is being used, I'll pick a different one. But it's a web reputation engine, I like to call it. What is it? It tells you that you're heading down this wrong path. People have gone down this path and they've ended up with this, that, and the other thing. Do you want to go, or would you like to heed this warning?
Oh.
Okay. So there are plenty of companies that are competing for that market place. One of them is My Web of Trust. They've had some controversies in the past. They depend on user input. So you and I would say, hey, don't go to Grandma's Cute Cat Videos. It's a fake. Or don't go to Pastor Evan's website because somebody hacked it. Okay. There is no authority that says this is true or this is not true. Mm-hmm. It's just a bunch of community input and some algorithm is used and some political discussions take place and a decision gets made. It's not the best tool on the planet, but it's better than nothing.
Okay. What do you recommend your customers do for backup data?
Two things. Cloud backup is very popular and has been thought out well enough that I can recommend it. On-site backup involves, you know, sticking an external hard drive to your computer and backing things up. On-site backup lends itself to the probability of becoming useless in case there's a flood or a fire, God forbid. Okay, so off-site backup was very popular many years ago where couriers would come to the corporation and say, hey, where are your backup tapes? Okay, they're in this lead box. Let me unlock it and give it to you. Okay, you got a receipt for me? Great, thanks. See you next week. Hmm. So they would come and take the backup tapes, take them somewhere else where it's safe, and then bring them back so we can reuse them. Well, online backup these days, like CrashPlan, various, you know, Carbonite, you've heard of these names. Some are better than others. Get one, anyone. It doesn't matter. CrashPlan seems to have the least amount of complaints that I hear I've had people rave about Carbonite. Pricing is one thing, security is another. And if you're just looking for backup, you don't want to get too deep into it and you want a name, go to CrashPlan or Carbonite. Call them up and say, well, what do you got for me and what's so special about you? And you'll get an earful.
All right. It seems that my computer is running slow. What could be wrong? What are some first things to look at?
First things I look at is I go and ask you which browser you use. Chrome, Firefox, Internet Explorer, Safari, whatever. I look at the browser. I open up the browser and I look at, are there any toolbars taking up the real estate where the website is supposed to show up? Usually 15 years ago, that would be common. Now they're hiding it as extensions. These are little add-ons, like the web protection engine I was talking to you about, like the ad blocker I was talking to you about. They put these fake things into the browser's helper object section, let's call it, and they help you to get something done. Well, mostly it's malicious. They track your movements and your behavior, and you search for Aunt Jemima, you're going to get Bisquick as a result because somebody somewhere is making a nickel off your clicking on Bisquick instead of Aunt Jemima. Very basic income scheme on the internet these days. Mm-hmm. There are lots of ways of making money on the internet, and some of them are better than others. So your computer's slow. The first thing I check is the browser because that's the first attack vector, especially if you're using Internet Explorer. You're just putting up a sign outside your house saying, come and get it.
Hmm.
And yeah, it takes some work to come and get it, but you're making it easy for people. So some people like Internet Explorer. I see people who are using it over other safer browsers. So I strengthen the browser with these security add-ons. I look for these red flags in the settings, in the convenience features areas of the browser. That's usually the telltale sign. I look at the space on the hard drive. I look at the number of icons and folders and pictures on the desktop. I look at what programs are running in the background. What was the last program that was installed? Do you remember installing it? If I tell you the date and time, if not, hey, guess what? Mm-hmm. You might have a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Usually it's internet-driven. When it's not internet-driven, when it's not a software-related issue, like I installed the wrong antivirus, it turned out to be a fake antivirus. When it's not that, it's hardware. Listening to a well-running machine is different than listening to the one with clogged fans and clicking hard drives. I would definitely check the size, the space left on the hard drive, whether it's a Windows or, more importantly, on a Mac. You need some slack space on your hard drive. There are lots of ways to look at the red flags and look for them. After all these years, I kind of go with my gut based on what is it that the customer is telling me? How are they articulating the problem that they're telling me? Are they comfortable with the vocabulary that they're using? Who is this person talking to me? What is my initial profile? What's my first impression? What are the answers coming to the questions that I have? That leads me in a path where I can take the pressure off you answering the questions, or I can dig deeper and say, hey, we could work together and figure out what happened and when it happened and who happened to make it happen. Mm-hmm. We can go deep into the forensics of it if need be. Most of the time people say it's slow. I say, here's why, and here's what you do about it. Mm-hmm. How do I find out? I always do a free diagnostic, no matter what. I could know what's going on backwards and forwards in my head. I need to confirm it. Mm-hmm. I need to wrap my brain around it in a way that I can make you understand what's going on. So I start with diagnosing things, and then generally within the first 5, 10, 15 minutes, I know that there's a list of things that we need to do to make things better. Is this list of things worthwhile doing? What's the cost of this computer on the resale market as it is? Is it worth spending the money on it? What if there's a hardware problem? There are lots of things that can be factored in to finding out why the machine is slow, but the most common reason is some sort of software came in and clogged things up and is acting as a helper object or a helper utility that's not really helping you all that much.
Okay. Every other day, it seems, I get a prompt to update Adobe Flash. Is that an important update?
Yes, and some years ago, they being the less righteous of us, they figured out that if they crafted a carefully built web page that looks like a message screen that you're used to seeing in Windows, then you're probably going to pay attention to it and just say, oh, I got to click next. What a pain. Well, hurry up already. And they've gone and installed a fake Flash player. Mm. That's because Flash, Java, and Adobe Reader, I call them, oh God, I hate to use this term, but the unholy trinity. Because they're not bad. They are not bad. It's the people who know how to use them that they find the security holes and exploit them. So consider how many computers are out there running Windows or Mac and are using and depending on these plugins. You can't get on the internet without these plugins on most sites. Recently, sites have been trying to work those plugins out of the mix in the way that they program and they create their web page. But you need to get your Adobe updates and Flash Player updates. Java, very important. Get your Java updates as soon as you notice the notification. Mm-hmm. These days, it's really hard to get faked out by a fake notification unless you're sitting out there on the internet and you're searching for something, and out of nowhere, somebody helpful who's a stranger to you that you can't see says, you better do this or bad things will happen, or you better call this number or bad things will happen, or, hey, mm-hmm. you want to watch this cute fat cat video? Just download this. It'll make it so much faster. Those days are not over, but they're not as prevalent as they used to be. So you get a notification, if you get it from the bottom right-hand side of your screen by the clock, depending on how your operating system is set up, most people recognize that's where the notifications show up. So I've learned, and I've tried to teach this to the people who are willing to do it, is, great, somebody said you should do something. Who are they? Now, they may be Adobe telling you that you need an update. Why don't you confirm it? Go to Adobe. You know who they are? They're at adobe.com. You don't even need a search engine to search for them. Mm-hmm. Go to adobe.com. Press enter. What was it they were talking about? Flash Player? Great. Click on Flash Player. It says, hey, there's a Flash Player you need to download. Maybe this is the same one that you have already. And if you go ahead and download it, no harm done. But if it was a fake one that you got from somewhere else, then you got yourself into a mess that you need to clean up. Mm-hmm. So great. Somebody says, get an update. I say, thanks for your input. Now go away, and I'm going to handle it myself.
Right. Now, that sort of leads into my next question. What are some of the most common scams, for lack of a better word, that people need to be aware of?
So it doesn't matter what website you're on. It could be CNN, could be Facebook, could be Yahoo, could be the Orange County Register, the LA Times. I don't care. They can be compromised by third-party advertising networks that get hacked or are unrighteous in the first place, and they're trying to pull a fast one. So you go to a website, and all of a sudden you get this window that might make noise, but it'll be a pop-up. It'll have an 800 number on it saying, hey, we're the Microsoft, and you're bugging us because you got viruses. Stop messing with our network. I've had people call me and say that they called this 800 number, and somebody with an accent said, Microsoft told us to call you to fix your computer. You're really putting a strain on our systems. You're sending out viruses. It's not a good thing.
Hmm.
All right. So the most common scam is just think of the old con man on the street corner with three-card Monty or whatever. There's nothing new under the sun, Pastor
mm-hmm.
Evan.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an electronic version of an old con. Somebody comes and says, boo, be afraid. Now, are you really afraid? Now, make this decision under duress. I want you to make a decision right now.
Mm-hmm.
Your something depends on it.
So same old tricks.
Same old tricks.
Okay. What advice would you give someone who is getting rid of their old computer, especially in terms of data security?
Well, here's a funny approach that's not necessarily the most environmentally friendly, but we have a lot of people locally that like to shoot things. And there's no better way to get rid of your data than to shoot it. Well, the poor little deer that ingest the heavy metals that scatter, they might not enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But your data will be safe. I've had people say, oh, yeah, I'll take that hard drive out of my computer and put it in a bucket of cement and bury it out the backyard. Okay. That's still not – it's very toxic, but, hey, cement will keep it from breaking down for a few years. There are services that will actually go and take a drill press and drill holes in your hard drive. I believe White City Metals used to do that. I don't know if they still do that anymore. I personally like the idea of wiping the hard drive clean using the Department of Defense method. It's not new. It's not especially complicated. It's just a matter of putting in a boot disk that people can download from anywhere online. It's called Kill Disk. There are various versions of softwares that you burn onto a disk and then you put into a CD-ROM drive or a flash drive or something, and you say go, and it destroys whatever storage it finds on the computer running this program. It might take 3 hours or 3 weeks depending on the size of the drive, but the idea is to take the drive, fill it with nonsensical data, then go over it again with some more nonsensical data, and then do it again. And the idea is that, okay, several layers of obfuscated information is going to be a lot harder for someone to pick up and pull off than a machine that you rip that hasn't been erased. If a nation state decides to come and un-erase what I erased, they will do it, and they would get their information. But the average kid who's too young to drive and too young to drink and wants to do something with their time is going to see this, and they're going to be deterred.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to say, oh, well, I'll tear it apart and use the magnets and put it on the fridge.
Okay.
So I offer a service. I don't charge for it for some reason. But you get your computer, and I've set up your new computer. The old one goes in the closet for about a month until we know for a fact that you do not need anything else off of this. At some point, you're going to be feeling comfortable like this thing needs to go, and then you give it to me. I say, here's a piece of paper that says, I, the undersigned, am going to rip the data off of this, and we're going to keep it safe. You're donating this. I'm going to clean it up, and I'm either going to use the parts for parts, or I'm going to donate it to somewhere or take it to eCycle with my other stuff. Why do I do it for free? Well, somebody's got to do it. Nobody wants to pay for it. If somebody says, oh, well, surely nothing bad could happen to your data if I take it for you and dispose of it, well, yeah, surely. We've heard that word before.
Mm-hmm.
I feel more comfortable giving proper advice to people. And if I have to take a machine home and plug it into my bench and put a CD in it and click next and walk away for 6 hours or 3 weeks, great.
Mm-hmm.
My service to you, my gift to you, congratulations. And in return, maybe there's a piece of hardware that I can use off of this thing, or I can clear out my garage and take all this stuff to the eCycle and start again. I know that's one way of making sure that a customer's data doesn't go anywhere is I take the responsibility and say, okay, I'm signing this contract and I'm giving it to you. And I'm taking this and taking it over there and it's going to go away as far as you're concerned. I might use your hard drive for testing. I might use the CD-ROM drive in another box. I might use these parts to give to people who can't afford the parts brand new. A lot of things can happen. Of all the machines that I've taken home and wiped clean, a good 75% of them are still sitting there holding up the dust. And I'm just waiting to do something with them. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while I realize, you see, you're not going to do anything with these things. Give them away. Fix them. Donate them. Take the e-cycle people up on their advice and have them come with a pickup truck and take all your stuff. They can make money, and it's a blessing for you. So what are you doing?
Sure. That's great. Well, we've been talking with Jimmy Attai from Happy Computing. The web address is happycomputing.net. You can also give him a call, 541-582-0345. Jimmy, this has been fun. Thanks for coming on.
I had a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You bet. Well, what do you think? Do you have an expert in town that we need to ask questions to? Let us know about it. Send us an email, feedback@943thebridge.com. The email address is feedback@943thebridge.com. Also, if you miss any of our previous broadcasts, you can go to our website and listen to them at your pleasure. Website address is 943thebridge.com. 943thebridge.com. You've been listening to Ask the Experts on 94.3 The Bridge. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you again next Friday here on 94.3 The Bridge.